The Quran and Modern Science. 1. Introduction. The relationship between the Quran and science is a priori a surprise, especially when it turns out to one of harmony, and not of discord. A confrontation between a religious book and the secular ideas proclaimed by science is perhaps, in the eyes of many people today, something of a paradox. The majority of today's scientists, with a small number of exceptions of course, are indeed bound up in materialist theories, and have only indifference or contempt for religious questions which they often consider to be founded on legend. In the West, moreover, when science and religion are discussed, people are quite willing to mention Judaism and Christianity among the religions referred to, but they hardly ever think of Islam. So many false judgments based on inaccurate ideas have indeed been made about it, that today it is very difficult to form an exact notion of the reality of Islam. As a prelude to any confrontation between the Islamic revelation and science, it would seem essential that an outline be given of a religion that is so little known in the West. The totally erroneous statements made about Islam in the West are sometimes the result of ignorance, and sometimes of systematic denigration. The most serious of all the untruths told about it are, however, those dealing with facts. While mistaken opinions are excusable, the presentation of facts running contrary to the reality is not. It is disturbing to read blatant untruths in eminently respectable works written by authors who a priori are highly qualified. The following is an example taken from the Universalis Encyclopedia, Volume 6. Under the heading Gospels, Evangiles, the author alludes to the differences between the latter and the Quran. The evangelists do not, as in the Quran, claim to transmit an autobiography that God miraculously dictated to the prophet. In fact, the Quran has nothing to do with an autobiography. It is a preaching, a consultation of even the worst translation would have made that clear to the author. The statement we have quoted is as far from reality as if one were to define a gospel as an account of an evangelist's life. The person responsible for this untruth about the Quran is a professor at the Jesuit Faculty of Theology, Lyon. The fact that people utter such untruths helps to give a false impression of the Quran and Islam. There is hope today, however, because religions are no longer as inward-looking as they were, and many of them are seeking for mutual understanding. One must indeed be impressed by a knowledge of the fact that an attempt is being made on the highest level of the hierarchy by Roman Catholics to establish contact with Muslims. They are trying to fight incomprehension and are doing their utmost to change the inaccurate views on Islam that are so widely held. In the introduction to this work, I mentioned the great change that has taken place in the last few years, and I quoted a document produced by the Office for Non-Christian Affairs at the Vatican under the title Orientations for a Dialogue Between Christians and Muslims, Orientations pour un dialogue entre chrétiens et musulmans. It is a very important document in that it shows the new position adopted towards Islam. As we read in the third edition of this study, 1970, this new position calls for a revision of our attitude towards it and a critical examination of our prejudices. We should first set about progressively changing the way our Christian brothers see it. This is the most important of all. We must clear away the outdated image inherited from the past, or distorted by prejudice and slander, and recognize the past injustice towards the Muslims for which the West, with its Christian education, is to blame. The Vatican document is nearly 150 pages long. It therefore expands on the refutation of classic views held by Christians on Islam and sets out the reality. Under the title Emancipating Ourselves from Our Worst Prejudices, the authors address the following suggestions to Christians. Here also, we must surrender to a deep purification of our attitude. In particular, what is meant by this are certain set judgments that are all too often, and too lightly made about Islam. It is essential not to cultivate in the secret of our hearts views such as these, too easily or arbitrarily arrived at, and which the sincere Muslim finds confusing. One extremely important view of this kind is the attitude which leads people to repeatedly use the term Allah to mean the God of the Muslims, as if the Muslims believed in a God who was different from the God of the Christians. Allah means the divinity in Arabic, it is a single God, implying that a correct transcription can only render the exact meaning of the word with the help of the expression God. For the Muslim, Allah is none other than the God of Moses and Jesus. The document produced by the Office for Non-Christian Affairs at the Vatican stresses this fundamental point in the following terms. It would seem pointless to maintain that Allah is not really God, as do certain people in the West. The conciliar documents have put the above assertion in its proper place. There is no better way of illustrating Islamic faith in God than by quoting the following extracts from Lumen Gentium. The Muslims profess the faith of Abraham and worship with us the sole merciful God, who is the future judge of men on the day of reckoning. One can therefore understand the Muslims' protest at the all too frequent custom in European languages of saying Allah instead of God. Cultivated Muslims have praised E. Masson's French translation of the Quran for having at last written Dieu instead of Allah. The Vatican document points out the following: Allah is the only word that Arabic-speaking Christians have for God. Muslims and Christians worship a single God. The Vatican document then undertakes a critical examination of the other false judgments made on Islam. Islamic fatalism is a widely spread prejudice. The document examines this and, quoting the Quran for support, it puts in opposition to this the notion of the responsibility man has, who is to be judged by his actions. It shows that the concept of an Islamic legalism is false. On the contrary, it opposes the sincerity of faith to this by quoting two phrases in the Quran that are highly misunderstood in the West. There is no compulsion in religion, 2-256. God has not laid upon you in religion any hardship, 2278. The document opposes the widely spread notion of Islam, religion of fear to Islam, religion of love, love of one's neighbor based on faith in God. It refutes the falsely spread notion that Muslim morality hardly exists and the other notion, shared by so many Jews and Christians, of Islamic fanaticism. It makes the following comment on this: in fact, Islam was hardly any more fanatical during its history than the sacred bastions of Christianity whenever the Christian faith took on, as it were, a political value. At this point, the authors quote expressions from the Quran that show how, in the West, the expression holy war has been mistranslated. In Arabic it is al-jihad fi sabil Allah, the effort on God's road, the effort to spread Islam and defend it against its aggressors. The Vatican document continues as follows. The jihad is not at all the biblical kerem, it does not lead to extermination, but to the spreading of God's and man's rights to new lands. The past violence of the jihad generally followed the rules of war. At the time of the Crusades, moreover, it was not always the Muslims that perpetrated the worst slaughters. Finally, the document deals with the prejudice according to which Islam is a hidebound religion which keeps its followers in a kind of superannuated Middle Ages, making them unfit to adapt to the technical conquests of the modern age. It compares analogous situations observed in Christian countries and states the following: we find, in the traditional expansion of Muslim thought, a principle of possible evolution in civilian society. I am certain that this defense of Islam by the Vatican will surprise many believers today, be they Muslims, Jews or Christians. It is a demonstration of sincerity and open-mindedness that is singularly in contrast with the attitudes inherited from the past. The number of people in the West who are aware of the new attitudes adopted by the highest authorities in the Catholic Church is, however, very small. Once one is aware of this fact, it comes as less of a surprise to learn of the actions that sealed this reconciliation. Firstly, there was the official visit made by the President of the Office for Non-Christian Affairs at the Vatican to King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, then the official reception given by Pope Paul VI to the Grand Ulama of Saudi Arabia in the course of 1974. Henceforth, one understands more clearly the spiritual significance of the fact that His Grace Bishop Elchinger received the Grand Ulama at his cathedral in Strasbourg and invited them during their visit to pray in the choir. This they did before the altar, turned towards Mecca. Thus the representatives of the Muslim and Christian worlds at their highest level, who share a faith in the same God and a mutual respect for their differences of opinion, have agreed to open a dialogue. This being so, it is surely quite natural for other aspects of each respective revelation to be confronted. The subject of this confrontation is the examination of the scriptures in the light of scientific data, and knowledge concerning the authenticity of the texts. This examination is to be undertaken for the Quran as it was for the Judeo-Christian revelation. The relationship between religions and science has not always been the same in any one place or time. It is a fact that there is no writing belonging to a monotheistic religion that condemns science. In practice, however, it must be admitted that scientists have had great difficulties with the religious authorities of certain creeds. For many centuries, in the Christian world, scientific development was opposed by the authorities in question, on their own initiative, and without reference to the authentic scriptures. We already know the measures taken against those who sought to enlarge science, measures which often made scientists go into exile to avoid being burnt at the stake, unless they recanted, changed their attitude and begged for pardon. The case of Galileo is always cited in this context. He was tried for having accepted the discoveries made by Copernicus on the rotation of the earth. Galileo was condemned as the result of a mistaken interpretation of the Bible, since not a single scripture could reasonably be brought against him. In the case of Islam, the attitude towards science was, generally speaking, quite different. Nothing could be clearer than the famous hadith of the Prophet, "Seek for science, even in China," or the other hadith which says that the search for knowledge is a strict duty for every Muslim man and woman. As we shall see further on in this section, another crucial fact is that the Quran, while inviting us to cultivate science, itself contains many observations on natural phenomena, and includes explanatory details which are seen to be in total agreement with modern scientific data. There is no equal to this in the Judeo-Christian revelation. It would nevertheless be wrong to imagine that, in the history of Islam, certain believers had never harbored a different attitude towards science. It is a fact that, at certain periods, the obligation to educate oneself and others was rather neglected. It is equally true that in the Muslim world, as elsewhere, an attempt was sometimes made to stop scientific development. All the same, it will be remembered that at the height of Islam, between the 8th and 12th centuries AD, that is, at a time when restrictions on scientific development were in force in the Christian world, a very large number of studies and discoveries were being made at Islamic universities. It was there that the remarkable cultural resources of the time were to be found. The California's library at Cordoba contained 400,000 volumes. Averroes was teaching there, and Greek, Indian, and Persian sciences were taught. This is why scholars from all over Europe went to study at Cordoba, just as today people go to the United States to perfect their studies. A very great number of ancient manuscripts have come down to us thanks to cultivated Arabs who acted as the vehicle for the culture of conquered countries. We are also greatly indebted to Arabic culture for mathematics. Algebra was an Arabic invention, astronomy, physics, optics, geology, botany, medicine, Avicenna, etc. For the very first time, science took on an international character in the Islamic universities of the Middle Ages. At this time, men were more steeped in the religious spirit than they are today, but in the Islamic world, this did not prevent them from being both believers and scientists. Science was the twin of religion, it should never have ceased to be so. The medieval period was, for the Christian world, a time of stagnation and absolute conformity. It must be stressed that scientific research was not slowed down by the Judeo-Christian revelation itself, but rather by those people who claimed to be its servants. Following the Renaissance, the scientists' natural reaction was to take vengeance on their former enemies. This vengeance still continues today, to such an extent indeed that in the West, anyone who talks of God in scientific circles really does stand out. This attitude affects the thinking of all young people who receive a university education, Muslims included. Their thinking could hardly be different from what it is considering the extreme positions adopted by the most eminent scientists. A Nobel Prize winner for medicine has tried in the last few years to persuade people, in a book intended for mass publication, that living matter was able to create itself by chance from several basic components. Starting, he says, with this primitive living matter, and under the influence of various external circumstances, organized living beings were formed, resulting in the formidable complex being that constitutes man. Surely these marvels of contemporary scientific knowledge in the field of life should lead a thinking person to the opposite conclusion. The organization presiding over the birth and maintenance of life surely appears more and more complicated as one studies it. The more details one knows, the more admiration it commands. A knowledge of this organization must surely lead one to consider as less and less probable the part chance has to play in the phenomenon of life. The further one advances along the road to knowledge, especially of the infinitely small, the more eloquent are the arguments in favor of the existence of a creator. Instead of being filled with humility in the face of such facts, man is filled with arrogance. He sneers at any idea of God, in the same way he runs down anything that detracts from his pleasure and enjoyment. This is the image of the materialist society that is flourishing at present in the West. What spiritual forces can be used to oppose this pollution of thought practiced by many contemporary scientists? Judaism and Christianity make no secret of their inability to cope with the tide of materialism and invasion of the West by atheism. Both of them are completely taken off guard, and from one decade to the next one can surely see how seriously diminished their resistance is to this tide that threatens to sweep everything away. The materialist atheist sees in classic Christianity nothing more than a system constructed by men over the last 2,000 years designed to ensure the authority of a minority over their fellow men. He is unable to find in Judeo-Christian writings any language that is even vaguely similar to his own. They contain so many improbabilities, contradictions and incompatibilities with modern scientific data, that he refuses to take texts into consideration that the vast majority of theologians would like to see accepted as an inseparable whole. When one mentions Islam to the materialist atheist, he smiles with a complacency that is only equal to his ignorance of the subject. In common with the majority of Western intellectuals, of whatever religious persuasion, he has an impressive collection of false notions about Islam. One must, on this point, allow him one or two excuses. Firstly, apart from the newly adopted attitudes prevailing among the highest Catholic authorities, Islam has always been subject in the West to a so-called secular slander. Anyone in the West who has acquired a deep knowledge of Islam knows just to what extent its history, dogma, and aims have been distorted. One must also take into account the fact that documents published in European languages on this subject, leaving aside highly specialized studies, do not make the work of a person willing to learn any easier. A knowledge of the Islamic revelation is indeed fundamental from this point of view. Unfortunately, passages from the Quran, especially those relating to scientific data, are badly translated and interpreted, so that a scientist has every right to make criticisms with apparent justification that the book does not actually deserve at all. This detail is worth noting henceforth. Inaccuracies in translation or erroneous commentaries, the one is often associated with the other, which would not have surprised anybody one or two centuries ago, offend today's scientists. When faced with a badly translated phrase containing a scientifically unacceptable statement, the scientist is prevented from taking the phrase into serious consideration. In the chapter on human reproduction, a very typical example will be given of this kind of error. Why do such errors in translation exist? They may be explained by the fact that modern translators often take up, rather uncritically, the interpretations given by older commentators. In their day, the latter had an excuse for having given an inappropriate definition to an Arabic word containing several possible meanings. They could not possibly have understood the real sense of the word or phrase, which has only become clear in the present day thanks to scientific knowledge. In other words, the problem is raised of the necessary revision of translations and commentaries. It was not possible to do this at a certain period in the past, but nowadays we have knowledge that enables us to render their true sense. These problems of translation are not present for the texts of the Judeo-Christian revelation. The case described here is absolutely unique to the Quran. These scientific considerations, which are very specific to the Quran, greatly surprised me at first. Up until then, I had not thought it possible for one to find so many statements in a text compiled more than 13 centuries ago referring to extremely diverse subjects and all of them totally in keeping with modern scientific knowledge. In the beginning, I had no faith whatsoever in Islam. I began this examination of the texts with a completely open mind and a total objectivity. If there was any influence acting upon me, it was gained from what I had been taught in my youth. People did not speak of Muslims, but of Mohammedans, to make it quite clear that what was meant was a religion founded by a man and which could not therefore have any kind of value in terms of God. Like many in the West, I could have retained the same false notions about Islam. They are so widely spread today, that I am indeed surprised when I come across anyone, other than a specialist, who can talk in an enlightened manner on this subject. I therefore admit that before I was given a view of Islam different from the one received in the West, I was myself extremely ignorant. I owe the fact that I was able to realize the false nature of the judgments generally made in the West about Islam to exceptional circumstances. It was in Saudi Arabia itself that an inkling was given to me of the extent to which opinions held in the West on this subject are liable to error. The debt of gratitude I owe to the late King Faisal, whose memory I salute with deepest respect, is indeed very great. The fact that I was given the signal honor of hearing him speak on Islam and was able to raise with him certain problems concerning the interpretation of the Quran in relation to modern science is a very cherished memory. It was an extremely great privilege for me to have gathered so much precious information from him personally and those around him. Since I had now seen the wide gap separating the reality of Islam from the image we have of it in the West, I experienced a great need to learn Arabic, which I did not speak, to be sufficiently well equipped to progress in the study of such a misunderstood religion. My first goal was to read the Quran and to make a sentence-by-sentence analysis of it with the help of various commentaries essential to a critical study. My approach was to pay special attention to the description of numerous natural phenomena given in the Quran, the highly accurate nature of certain details referring to them in the book, which was only apparent in the original, struck me by the fact that they were in keeping with present-day ideas, although a man living at the time of Muhammad could not have suspected this at all. I subsequently read several works written by Muslim authors on the scientific aspects of the Quranic text. They were extremely helpful in my appreciation of it, but I have not so far discovered a general study of this subject made in the West. What initially strikes the reader confronted for the first time with a text of this kind is the sheer abundance of subjects discussed: the creation, astronomy, the explanation of certain matters concerning the earth, and the animal and vegetable kingdoms, human reproduction. Whereas monumental errors are to be found in the Bible, I could not find a single error in the Quran. I had to stop and ask myself, if a man was the author of the Quran, how could he have written facts in the 7th century AD that today are shown to be in keeping with modern scientific knowledge? There was absolutely no doubt about it, the text of the Quran we have today is most definitely a text of the period, if I may be allowed to put it in these terms. In the next chapter of the present section of the book I shall be dealing with this problem. What human explanation can there be for this observation? In my opinion, there is no explanation. There is no special reason why an inhabitant of the Arabian Peninsula should, at a time when King Dagobert was reigning in France, 629-639 AD, have had scientific knowledge on certain subjects that was 10 centuries ahead of our own. It is an established fact that at the time of the Quranic revelation, that is, within a period of roughly 20 years straddling Hijra, 622 AD, scientific knowledge had not progressed for centuries, and the period of activity in Islamic civilization, with its accompanying scientific upsurge, came after the close of the Quranic revelation. Only ignorance of such religious and secular data can lead to the following bizarre suggestion I have heard several times: if surprising statements of a scientific nature exist in the Quran, they may be accounted for by the fact that Arab scientists were so far ahead of their time and Muhammad was influenced by their work. Anyone who knows anything about Islamic history is aware that the period of the Middle Ages, which saw the cultural and scientific upsurge in the Arab world, came after Muhammad, and would not therefore indulge in such whims. Suggestions of this kind are particularly off the mark because the majority of scientific facts which are either suggested or very clearly recorded in the Quran have only been confirmed in modern times. It is easy to see, therefore, how for centuries commentators on the Quran, including those writing at the height of Islamic culture, have inevitably made errors of interpretation in the case of certain verses whose exact meaning could not possibly have been grasped. It was not until much later, at a period not far from our own, that it was possible to translate and interpret them correctly. This implies that a thorough linguistic knowledge is not in itself sufficient to understand these verses from the Quran. What is needed along with this is a highly diversified knowledge of science. A study such as the present one embraces many disciplines and is in that sense encyclopedic. As the questions raised are discussed, the variety of scientific knowledge essential to the understanding of certain verses of the Quran will become clear. The Quran does not aim at explaining certain laws governing the universe, however, it has an absolutely basic religious objective. The descriptions of divine omnipotence are what principally incite man to reflect on the works of creation. They are accompanied by references to facts accessible to human observation or to laws defined by God who presides over the organization of the universe both in the sciences of nature and as regards man. One part of these assertions is easily understood, but the meaning of the other can only be grasped if one has the essential scientific knowledge it requires. This means that in former times, man could only distinguish an apparent meaning which led him to draw the wrong conclusions on account of the inadequacy of his knowledge at the time in question. It is possible that the choice of verses from the Quran which are to be studied for their scientific content may perhaps seem too small for certain Muslim writers who have already drawn attention to them before I have. In general, I believe I have retained a slightly smaller number of verses than they have. On the other hand, I have singled out several verses which until now have not, in my opinion, been granted the importance they deserve from a scientific point of view. Wherever I may have mistakenly failed to take verses into consideration for this study that were selected by these writers, I hope that they will not hold it against me. I have also found, on occasion, that certain books contain scientific interpretations which do not appear to me to be correct. It is with an open mind and a clear conscience that I have provided personal interpretations of such verses. By the same token, I have tried to find references in the Quran to phenomena accessible to human comprehension but which have not been confirmed by modern science. In this context, I think I may have found references in the Quran to the presence of planets in the universe that are similar to the Earth. It must be added that many scientists think this is a perfectly feasible fact, although modern data cannot provide any hint of certainty. I thought I owed it to myself to mention this, whilst retaining all the attendant reservations that might be applied. Had this study been made 30 years ago, it would have been necessary to add another fact predicted by the Quran to what would have been cited concerning astronomy. This fact is the conquest of space. At that time, subsequent to the first trials of ballistic missiles, people imagined a day when man would perhaps have the material possibility of leaving his earthly habitat and exploring space. It was then known that a verse existed in the Quran predicting how one day man would make this conquest. This statement has now been verified. The present confrontation between Holy Scripture and science brings ideas into play, both for the Bible and the Quran, which concern scientific truth. For this confrontation to be valid, the scientific arguments to be relied upon must be quite soundly established and must leave no room for doubt. Those who balk at the idea of accepting the intervention of science in an appreciation of the scriptures deny that it is possible for science to constitute a valid term of comparison, whether it be the Bible, which does not escape the comparison unscathed, and we have seen why, or the Quran, which has nothing to fear from science. Science, they say, is changing with the times, and a fact accepted today may be rejected later. This last comment calls for the following observation: a distinction must be drawn between scientific theory and duly controlled observed fact. Theory is intended to explain a phenomenon or a series of phenomena not readily understandable. In many instances, theory changes, it is liable to be modified or replaced by another theory when scientific progress makes it easier to analyze facts and envisage a more viable explanation. On the other hand, an observed fact checked by experimentation is not liable to modification, it becomes easier to define its characteristics, but it remains the same. It has been established that the Earth revolves around the Sun and the Moon around the Earth, and this fact will not be subject to revision. All that may be done in the future is to define the orbits more clearly. A regard for the changing nature of theory is, for example, what made me reject a verse from the Quran thought by a Muslim physicist to predict the concept of antimatter, a theory which is at present the subject of much debate. One can, on the other hand, quite legitimately devote great attention to a verse from the Quran describing the aquatic origins of life, a phenomenon we shall never be able to verify, but which has many arguments that speak in its favor. As for observed facts such as the evolution of the human embryo, it is quite possible to confront different stages described in the Quran with the data of modern embryology and find complete concordance between modern science and the verses of the Quran referring to this subject. This confrontation between the Quran and science has been completed by two other comparisons. One is the confrontation of modern knowledge with biblical data on the same subjects, and the other is the comparison from the same scientific point of view between the data in the Quran, the Book of Revelation transmitted by God to the Prophet, and the data in the Ahadith, books narrating the deeds and sayings of Muhammad that lie outside the written revelation. At the end of this, the third section of the present work, the detailed results of the comparison between the biblical and Quranic description of a single event are given, along with an account of how the passage fared when subjected to the scientific criticism of each description. An examination has, for example, been made in the case of the creation and of the flood. In each instance, the incompatibilities with science in the biblical description have been made clear. Also to be seen is the complete agreement between science and the descriptions in the Quran referring to them. We shall note precisely those differences that make one description scientifically acceptable in the present day and the other unacceptable. This observation is of prime importance, since in the West, Jews, Christians and atheists are unanimous in stating, without a scrap of evidence however, that Muhammad wrote the Quran, or had it written as an imitation of the Bible. It is claimed that stories of religious history in the Quran resume biblical stories. This attitude is as thoughtless as saying that Jesus himself duped his contemporaries by drawing inspiration from the Old Testament during his preachings. The whole of Matthew's Gospel is based on this continuation of the Old Testament, as we have indeed seen already. What expert in exegesis would dream of depriving Jesus of his status as God's envoy for this reason? This is nevertheless the way that Muhammad is judged more often than not in the West. All he did was to copy the Bible. It is a summary judgment that does not take account of the fact that the Quran and the Bible provide different versions of a single event. People prefer not to talk about the difference in the descriptions. They are pronounced to be the same and thus scientific knowledge need not be brought in. We shall enlarge on these problems when dealing with the description of the creation and the flood. The collections of Ahadith are to Muhammad what the Gospels are to Jesus, descriptions of the actions and sayings of the Prophet. Their authors were not eyewitnesses. This applies at least to the compilers of the collections of Ahadith, which are said to be the most authentic and were collected much later than the time when Muhammad was alive. They do not in any way constitute books containing the written revelation. They are not the word of God, but the sayings of the Prophet. In these books, which are very widely read, statements are to be found containing errors from a scientific point of view, especially medical remedies. We naturally discount anything relating to problems of a religious kind, since they are not discussed here in the context of the Ahadith. Many Ahadith are of doubtful authenticity. They are discussed by Muslim scientists themselves. When the scientific nature of one of the Ahadith is touched upon in the present work, It is essentially to put into relief all that distinguishes them from the Quran itself when seen from this point of view, since the latter does not contain a single scientific statement that is unacceptable. The difference, as we shall see, is quite startling. The above observation makes the hypothesis advanced by those who see Muhammad as the author of the Quran quite untenable. How could a man, from being illiterate, become the most important author, in terms of literary merit, in the whole of Arabic literature? How could he then pronounce truths of a scientific nature that no other human being could possibly have developed at the time, and all this without once making the slightest error in his pronouncements on the subject? The ideas in this study are developed from a purely scientific point of view. They lead to the conclusion that it is inconceivable for a human being living in the 7th century AD to have made statements in the Quran on a great variety of subjects that do not belong to his period and for them to be in keeping with what was to be known only centuries later. For me, there can be no human explanation to the Quran. 2. Authenticity of the Quran, how it came to be written. Thanks to its undisputed authenticity, the text of the Quran holds a unique place among the books of Revelation, shared neither by the Old nor the New Testament. In the first two sections of this work, a review was made of the alterations undergone by the Old Testament and the Gospels before they were handed down to us in the form we know today. The same is not true for the Quran for the simple reason that it was written down at the time of the Prophet. We shall see how it came to be written, that is, the process involved. In this context, the differences separating the Quran from the Bible are in no way due to questions essentially concerned with date. Such questions are constantly put forward by certain people without regard to the circumstances prevailing at the time when the Judeo-Christian and the Quranic revelations were written. They have an equal disregard for the circumstances surrounding the transmission of the Quran to the Prophet. It is suggested that a 7th century text had more likelihood of coming down to us unaltered than other texts that are as many as 15 centuries older. This comment, although correct, does not constitute a sufficient reason. It is made more to excuse the alterations made in the Judeo-Christian texts in the course of centuries than to underline the notion that the text of the Quran, which was more recent, had less to fear from being modified by man. In the case of the Old Testament, the sheer number of authors who tell the same story, plus all the revisions carried out on the text of certain books from the pre-Christian era, constitute as many reasons for inaccuracy and contradiction. As for the Gospels, nobody can claim that they invariably contain faithful accounts of Jesus's words or a description of his actions, strictly in keeping with reality. We have seen how successive versions of the texts showed a lack of definite authenticity and moreover that their authors were not eyewitnesses. Also to be underlined is the distinction to be made between the Quran, a book of written revelation, and the Ahadith, collections of statements concerning the actions and sayings of Muhammad. Some of the Prophet's companions started to write them down from the moment of his death. As an element of human error could have slipped in, the collection had to be resumed later and subjected to rigorous criticism so that the greatest credit is in practice given to documents that came along after Muhammad. Their authenticity varies, like that of the Gospels. Not a single Gospel was written down at the time of Jesus, they were all written long after his earthly mission had come to an end, and not a single collection of Ahadith was compiled during the time of the Prophet. The situation is very different for the Quran. As the revelation progressed, the Prophet and the believers following him recited the text by heart and it was also written down by the scribes in his following. It therefore starts off with two elements of authenticity that the Gospels do not possess. This continued up to the Prophet's death. At a time when not everybody could write, but everyone was able to recite, recitation afforded a considerable advantage because of the double-checking possible when the definitive text was compiled. The Quranic revelation was made by Archangel Gabriel to Muhammad. It took place over a period of more than 20 years of the Prophet's life, beginning with the first verses of Surah 96, then resuming after a three-year break for a long period of 20 years up to the death of the Prophet in 632 AD, that is, 10 years before Hijra, and 10 years after Hijra. The following was the first revelation. Read, in the name of thy Lord who created man from something which clings, read. Thy Lord is the most noble who taught by the pen who taught man what he did not know. 96:1-5. Professor Hamidullah notes in the introduction to his French translation of the Quran that one of the themes of this first revelation was the praise of the pen as a means of human knowledge, which would explain the Prophet's concern for the preservation of the Quran in writing. Texts formally prove that long before the Prophet left Mecca for Medina, that is, long before Hijra, the Quranic text so far revealed had been written down. We shall see how the Quran is authentic in this. We know that Muhammad and the believers who surrounded him were accustomed to reciting the revealed text from memory. It is therefore inconceivable for the Quran to refer to facts that did not square with reality, because the latter could so easily be checked with people in the Prophet's following, by asking the authors of the transcription. Four surahs dating from a period prior to Hijra refer to the writing down of the Quran before the Prophet left Mecca in 622, Surah 80, verses 11-16. By no means. Indeed, it is a message of instruction, therefore whoever wills, should remember. On lees held in honor, exalted, purified in the hands of scribes noble and pious. 80:11-16. Yusuf Ali, in the commentary to his translation, 1934, wrote that when the revelation of this surah was made, 42 or 45 others had been written and were kept by Muslims in Mecca, out of a total of 114. Nay, this is a glorious reading. On a preserved tablet, 85:21-22. This is a glorious reading. 52 in a book well kept which none but the purified teach. This is a revelation from the Lord of the Worlds. 56:77-80. They said, tales of the ancients which he has caused to be written, and they are dictated to him morning and evening. 25:5. Here we have a reference to the accusations made by the Prophet's enemies who treated him as an impostor. They spread the rumor that stories of antiquity were being dictated to him and he was writing them down or having them transcribed. The meaning of the word is debatable, but one must remember that Muhammad was illiterate. However this may be, the verse refers to this act of making a written record, which is pointed out by Muhammad's enemies themselves. A surah that came after Hijra makes one last mention of the leaves on which these divine instructions were written. An apostle from God recites leaves kept pure where our decrees right and straight. 98:2-3. The Quran itself therefore provides indications as to the fact that it was set down in writing at the time of the Prophet. It is a known fact that there were several scribes in his following, the most famous of whom, Zayd ibn Thabit, has left his name to posterity. In the preface to his French translation of the Quran, 1971, Professor Hamidullah gives an excellent description of the conditions that prevailed when the text of the Quran was written, lasting up until the time of the Prophet's death. The sources all agree in stating that whenever a fragment of the Quran was revealed, the Prophet called one of his literate companions and dictated it to him, indicating at the same time the exact position of the new fragment in the fabric of what had already been received. Descriptions note that Muhammad asked the scribe to reread to him what had been dictated so that he could correct any deficiencies. Another famous story tells how every year in the month of Ramadan, the Prophet would recite the whole of the Quran, so far revealed, to Gabriel, that in the Ramadan preceding Muhammad's death, Gabriel had made him recite it twice. It is known how since the Prophet's time, Muslims acquired the habit of keeping vigil during Ramadan, and of reciting the whole of the Quran in addition to the usual prayers expected of them. Several sources add that Muhammad's scribe Zayd was present at this final bringing together of the texts. Elsewhere, numerous other personalities are mentioned as well. Extremely diverse materials were used for this first record: parchment, leather, wooden tablets, camel's scapula, soft stone for inscriptions, etc. At the same time, however, Muhammad recommended that the faithful learn the Quran by heart. They did this for a part, if not all, of the text recited during prayers. Thus there were Hafsian who knew the whole of the Quran by heart and spread it abroad. The method of doubly preserving the text both in writing and by memorization proved to be extremely precious. Not long after the Prophet's death, 632, his successor Abu Bakr, the first caliph of Islam, asked Muhammad's former head scribe, Zayd ibn Thabit, to make a copy. This he did. On Omar's initiative, the future second caliph, Zayd consulted all the information he could assemble at Medina, the witness of the Hafsian, copies of the book written on various materials belonging to private individuals, all with the object of avoiding possible errors in transcription. Thus an extremely faithful copy of the book was obtained. The sources tell us that Caliph Omar, Abu Bakr's successor in 634, subsequently made a single volume mushaf that he preserved and gave on his death to his daughter Hafsa, the Prophet's widow. The third caliph of Islam, Uthman, who held the caliphate from 644 to 655, entrusted a commission of experts with the preparation of the great recension that bears his name. It checked the authenticity of the document produced under Abu Bakr, which had remained in Hafsa's possession until that time. The commission consulted Muslims who knew the text by heart. The critical analysis of the authenticity of the text was carried out very rigorously. The agreement of the witnesses was deemed necessary before the slightest verse containing debatable material was retained. It is indeed known how some verses of the Quran correct others in the case of prescriptions. This may be readily explained when one remembers that the Prophet's period of apostolic activity stretched over 20 years, in round figures. The result is a text containing an order of surahs that reflects the order followed by the Prophet in his complete recital of the Quran during Ramadan, as mentioned above. One might perhaps ponder the motives that led the first three caliphs, especially Uthman, to commission collections and recensions of the text. The reasons are in fact very simple. Islam's expansion in the very first decades following Muhammad's death was very rapid indeed, and it happened among peoples whose native language was not Arabic. It was absolutely necessary to ensure the spread of a text that retained its original purity. Uthman's recension had this as its objective. Uthman sent copies of the text of the recension to the centers of the Islamic Empire, and that is why, according to Professor Hamidullah, copies attributed to Uthman exist in Tashkent and Istanbul. Apart from one or two possible mistakes in copying, the oldest documents known to the present day, that are to be found throughout the Islamic world, are identical. The same is true for documents preserved in Europe. There are fragments in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris which, according to the experts, date from the 8th and 9th centuries AD, that is, the 2nd and 3rd Hegirian centuries. The numerous ancient texts that are known to be in existence all agree except for very minor variations which do not change the general meaning of the text at all. If the context sometimes allows more than one interpretation, it may well have to do with the fact that ancient writing was simpler than that of the present day. The 114 surahs were arranged in decreasing order of length. There were nevertheless exceptions. The chronological sequence of the revelation was not followed. In the majority of cases, however, this sequence is known. A large number of descriptions are mentioned at several points in the text, sometimes giving rise to repetitions. Very frequently a passage will add details to a description that appears elsewhere in an incomplete form. Everything connected with modern science is, like many subjects dealt with in the Quran, scattered throughout the book without any semblance of classification.